Okay, today is January 11th, 2016, almost said 2015. This is the fourth and probably final interview with Kevin Riley. We're here at Steenbach Memorial Library at the University Archives, and my name is Troy Reeves. Kevin, as we've done for each of these sessions, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure. Kevin Riley, and the last name spelled R-E-I-L-L-Y.
Great. I'm going to move this in between us. Okay, so I think all that's left as far as the key topics you want to touch on is the competency-based degree program. So let's start there today.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was an innovation that I introduced toward the end of my time as president of the system, and based on a number of things. We know we have more adult students now. The majority age of students is well above the 18 to 22-year-old traditional student age, and we have, in the kind of economy that operates now, many adults who have college credits but not a degree, not a credential, who need to get a credential or degree to advance in their careers, generally speaking, and some of them want to do it for personal and enrichment reasons as well, but certainly a lot of pressure on the professional career development side for people to do that. And obviously somebody who's working full-time, has family, job, responsibilities, a mortgage, and the rest is not going to be able to come to a campus and be a resident student for a year or year and a half to finish off the credits needed for a baccalaureate degree. So one of the questions we started to ask ourselves is, what can we really do for these students? And Wisconsin has a population of a little over 5 million people. We did a survey that would indicate projections that something between 750,000 and a million adults had some college credit but not a degree in the state. Huge percentage, obviously. So, and these are taxpaying citizens who are helping to pay the freight for the university by paying their state taxes, and they're also people who are less likely to leave the state if they do earn a degree because they're rooted here by family, job, other responsibilities. So working with the chancellors, we put together this competency-based degree program. And the notion there is to allow people to demonstrate what they know through assessments and get credit or advancement toward a degree through those assessments. And this is in some ways not new. Lots of colleges and universities have been looking at what they call prior learning assessment in one way or another, but it hasn't really been used very widely in most places, wasn't used very widely in the University of Wisconsin system. And in most instances, you couldn't earn a full degree using a lot of this method. It would be the kind of thing where you might get a couple credits for having been a reporter if you had an associate degree and you were coming back and you could demonstrate, you could test out of freshman English, for instance. You get three credits or maybe six if you tested out of two semesters. And foreign languages use that a lot as well. If you could demonstrate you had a certain level of proficiency in French, you could fulfill your language requirement or go on into the intermediate French course, having earned the credits maybe for the beginner French course. But not widely used. So we worked hard to put together a system whereby we said to faculty who were nervous about this, understandably, because this means, well, wait a minute, I'm not going to teach the students. They're going to get credit without my teaching them what I know. So we assured the faculty of three things. They would be involved in lining out what the competencies were in their disciplines, where we would have competency-based degrees. They would create the assessments by which they would determine whether students had indeed gotten those competencies or brought those competencies to the university when they came as adult students, say. And three, the faculty would be the ones who would set the standards by which the passing or failing or grades would be determined on those assessments. And that's been the way it's worked. We have now seven or eight, I think, degrees that are being offered across the system in that way at different institutions, and there will be more in the years to come, I hope. Many of them are, not surprisingly, career-oriented in the sense that nursing is one. One in information sciences that is an interesting one out of Milwaukee, because that's really aimed at people who are in the business of building and maintaining information infrastructure for all different kinds of organizations. One in medical diagnostic imaging, for instance. So, and there is a two-year one that the college has put together that's their liberal arts and sciences general ed program, basically. So I think if we're going to be a university for the 21st century and beyond, where we are dealing more and more with adult students and students, even younger ones, who bring a variety of competencies to us, we need to be able to assess those and award credit and let people get on with it. That is, you know, it makes no sense for anybody involved to say to somebody who can demonstrate that they're a really proficient writer, okay, you have to sit through two semesters of freshman English because it's a requirement that you take freshman English. Well, the requirement should be you demonstrate competency in written English at a certain level. And you can do that if you don't come with it by taking freshman English and passing that course. Or you can do a writing assessment when you come in, again, created by the faculty, the assessment of it created by the faculty, the competencies you have to demonstrate established by the faculty, the cutoff scores, if you want to think of it that way, for credit established by the faculty. But that's there. And so we're not wasting your time and money by making you sit through two semesters of freshman English. We're opening up more seats in freshman English for other students who need to take the course. Mm-hmm. And we're saving taxpayers money by not forcing additional students to use that resource of that freshman English professor's class when they clearly don't need it. And, you know, on so many of these kinds of debates, I'd like to go back when we talked about them internally and say, look, we're supposed to be evidence-based organizations as universities, right? We think of ourselves as organizations that don't make judgments, don't set ourselves up based on what we think might be nice. We have evidence to say this is what works, this is what doesn't. Well, if somebody comes in and can show us convincing evidence that they have a competency, we ought to recognize that, not put our heads in the sand about it, but recognize that and let them get along and move on more quickly and efficiently toward their degree. And, of course, when you think of it this way, the longer somebody needs to stay in school, if you're a returning adult and you have a job, you're probably, you know, there's an economic loss to you by virtue of that. And if you could get on sooner with a higher level job because you had a degree, there's an economic gain for you and an economic gain for the society in terms of the additional skills you would have and bring to the job, and arguably an economic gain to the society, because if you can demonstrate those skills well back at the job, you get a promotion, you get a salary increase, and you're paying higher taxes back to the good of the whole. So, interesting development. We were the first public university system to establish competency-based degree programs in the country, and got a lot of attention for that, and a lot of people around the country coming to visit to say, boy, what are you doing here? How have you done this? Up until we decided to do this, Troy, there were a couple largely private, small campuses doing it. Southern New Hampshire was a real leader in this. But, you know, their number of students and graduates is relatively small until major institutions start to look at this and implement it. And again, we were the first major institution to implement it. It's not going to make a huge difference, but I hope more and more will look at it. And it's not an either or. Again, will some 17-year-olds want to come and get the full immersion in a residential experience and take a whole bunch of really interesting courses from great professors? Absolutely. You know, again, if you're a 38-year-old single mother from Wausau and you need to get that bachelor's in business degree to advance your into the supervisory ranks, well, you're not going to be able to do that. And we ought to have a way that that person can get a good education and a solid credential and move on with it. And even within the competency-based degree programs themselves, the notion there is that you should be able to, if you want, take the freshman English course. If you feel, well, maybe, gee, I think I'm up to maybe the first semester competency, but I think I probably ought to take that second semester. We'll take it. And that was an argument that I made to the faculty in particular, is that I think if we structure this right, it will put additional students into your classrooms, because people will be able to earn credit in a variety of ways. But for some of them, for some courses, they may say, boy, for pre-calculus, I'm not going to try to do this on my own, and I don't have enough background I bring. I'm going to take that pre-calculus course from Professor X and combine that with credits earned through competency-based assessments to move toward a degree. So again, we often think of these things in kind of binary terms. It's you either earn your degree this way or you earn your degree that way. Well, no, more and more people are earning their degrees in a variety of ways that we're making possible now that we didn't before, and that's all to everybody's good.
Kevin, if you mentioned this during that initial overview, I apologize, but it sounds like you definitely talked about how you pitched it and proposed it to the faculty. Once it got approved, how did you let these, 750,000 to 1 million Wisconsinites know that this is a thing that they can be involved in?
Well, we had UW Extension coordinating the development of these degree programs, even though at that point, when this started, the degree programs were all being offered by one or the other of the campuses. And they were all being offered, Troy, by departments that were offering traditional, quote-unquote, degree programs in their discipline. So these were competency-based degree programs were created by those same faculty who taught the regular program in diagnostic imaging, who taught the regular nursing program, who taught the regular information sciences program. And Extension, being the outreach arm of the university system, was the right place to coordinate the development, and we asked them to take on the marketing of it and the advertisement of it. The Governor Walker and I flew around the state to make the announcement of our doing this, three different places in one day, and he was very very supportive of this concept. So Extension was carrying that portfolio, but I certainly tried in every way I could to get the word out and use my bully pulpit to do that, and did some writing on it and speaking on it in national conferences and other places. And then, as I said, we made a big splash announcement with the governor when they first got started.
So even though this was towards the end of your tenure, were you able to see statistics that this was starting to work?
Well, it is, and it was quite close to the end of my tenure, and we made a conscious decision, and I think the right one, to start small. Not to say, okay, we're going to have 10,000 people in this in the first year. So they started with, I think, around 250, and they've gradually increased it. I couldn't tell you exactly how many are in it now, but I know they've had more takers than they've had the ability to admit people, and the numbers are growing. And the number of degrees offered in this format grow, there will be more people coming in and interested in taking it. One of the things I did was I asked Aaron Brower, who at the time was an associate provost for teaching and learning at UW-Madison, to come over to UW Extension and lead the development of this. And I think Aaron's done a great job working with Ray Cross, who was then the Extension Chancellor, now the System President, in putting this thing together. It's very tricky, obviously, to do for a whole range of reasons. But part of the reason I asked Aaron to do it was I thought he had the academic credibility, faculty member at Madison, associate provost for teaching and learning, and that he could speak with authority and understanding to and with his faculty colleagues about why this was a good idea. So I think when you initiate something like this, where you know there will be internal resistance, externally there was mostly entirely applause, really. But when you know there'll be some resistance internally, for good and valid reasons, having a really credible point person taking the lead on it is very important. And I think Aaron was that right person at the right time, and he's continued to work really hard at it.
Did you start, you said you started small, did you start with those eight?
There were, let's see, in the first round, the very first offerings, it might have been more like five than eight. It may be eight now, but there are new ones coming on each year. So it was in that range exactly. Okay. I don't have the precise number.
All right.
But I think five was the initial number out of the box.
Just jotting down.
Sure, take your time.
All right, so I guess I don't have anything else I want to ask about that. I know you had some accomplishments there. I think we've touched on most of those accomplishments as you've been talking about these overarching topics.
I think we did, and I can kind of summarize some of that without getting into the metrics of increased enrollment and transfer. It's sort of the bigger picture when we get to the end.
But, okay. So I guess we're at the point where I want to ask you about why you retired. So
sure.
If you want to talk about that, and if you want to incorporate any of those statistics or talk about the statistics before, I'll let you decide how.
Sure. Well, I'll just mention them. You know, in terms of looking back to my thing, we ought to be an evidence-based organization. What's the evidence of accomplishment for your presidency, Dr. Riley? Well, just looking at some metrics, enrollment increased 9%. During my time as president across the system to the highest ever at 182,000 students. And that, again, was a conscious effort and product of the growth agenda for Wisconsin. At the same time, the degrees granted increased 13%, higher than the enrollment. Again, I'd argue that shows we were using our resources efficiently. It wasn't just that we got an extra body and graduated an extra body 4 or 5 or 6 years down the line. We did some things to graduate more bodies than new ones we were taking in the front door. And part of that was we increased transfer by 13% as well. So that was a conscious effort to use the resources of higher education in the state and elsewhere as a whole to attract students who may have started somewhere else or may have gotten an associate degree at a community college or a technical college up into the university. And we talked at some length already about the increase, large percentage increase in privately raised need-based financial aid, and the sponsored research continued to grow beyond $1 billion a year, most of that at Madison, but some of it at the other campuses as well, a little bit at least, mostly Milwaukee is the other campus. And let me just say on that last one, I think people often don't connect the dots this way, but I think that the sponsored research we do and the turning of some of that, the resulting of some of that into new industries and new jobs in the state is a really important set of dots to connect, right? So, and again, if you just think of UW-Madison, you've got the University Research Park a couple miles west of the Madison campus, and I think there are now something close to 5,000 people employed there. I think the average salary, I haven't looked at this in a couple years, but it was, I don't know, 46,000 or something. I think it was 60,000, which was well above, I think the average salary in Wisconsin was around 43. So these folks are making considerably more than the average income in Wisconsin. And those companies are there either because they were spun out directly from university research, or they're companies that came to the research park because they wanted to be around those companies and around that kind of intellectual ferment that leads to new products and services, many of them health-related drugs and procedures. So you've got two sides to this coin. You want to graduate more highly educated people, on the one hand, from the university, and on the other, you want the university to be using its resources to create new jobs that some of those graduates will go into. And you have to do both of those things successfully simultaneously. And I'd argue that we did just that. And, you know, if you produce a lot of additional graduates and there are no jobs in the state, the graduates leave and go elsewhere to get the jobs. If you have a lot of good jobs in the state that are going begging, the corporations increasingly leave. I mean, they pull up stakes and they want to be where there's a young, highly educated, energetic, entrepreneurial labor base, and they go. They're mobile. So you've got to both be, you know, stocking that new age workforce and at the same time building the industries and jobs that will employ them. And, you know, when you look internationally at some of the biggest, newest corporations that are employing millions of people around the globe, and I mean, you know, the Facebooks, the Microsofts, the Googles, these are industries that didn't exist at all not that long ago, and they're industries and companies that have grown out of university research and the computer sciences, largely, and social media. So the university does produce those big new industries at the same time that it helps to sustain agriculture and manufacturing, where we work with the Advanced Manufacturing Center at Milwaukee to help the manufacturing sector over there, and all the work we continue to do with agriculture. And again, that helps create 21st century jobs, even in the older industries, the more stable and staple industries in Wisconsin. So you've got to connect the growth agenda and economic development and job creation if you're going to be a successful 21st century university.
Thank you. I think there is one thing I want to say before we move to why retire, and maybe it's connected, is that you have statistics here showing things are good.
Right.
But I'm guessing things weren't, you know, everything didn't turn out exactly as you planned.
Sure.
And this one-page article that you pointed me to that the Wisconsin State Journal did, the editorial, I think it had, I'm going to take a second here.
Sure.
I can't. He oversaw some, so there's this sentence that says, for example, he oversaw some costly computer fiascos.
Right, yeah.
Before we get to why retire, and again, it might be connected, you know, what are some of the things that you feel like didn't go as well as you hoped they
sure,
did?
Sure. So let me go back and say, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I was chancellor at University of Wisconsin Extension for 4 years and then president of the system for almost 10. So I had a 14-year run as a chancellor, president, chief executive. That's a long run these days. I mean, a lot longer than most people in these jobs actually stay. And when you're in the job for that long, you're going to have some things that go really well, and you're going to have some things that don't go as well as you would like. You're going to make some mistakes. You're going to take some justified criticism. Just the nature of the beast in any large complex organization, whether it's the public sector or the private sector, you're going to have some problems. So one of the problems we did have that you just alluded to from that Journal Sentinel editorial was the introduction of a new human resources computer system, right? And when I came in to the job early on, I was being told, you know, our payroll system, for instance, part of the human resources operation, is held together at this point by, somebody said, chewing gum and band-aids, or rubber bands, rather, chewing gum and rubber bands. And we have, it's an old mainframe system. We have a couple older employees running it. They're going to retire at some point. We can't hire younger people to run it because there's no future in that. They're onto these different kinds of more sophisticated systems. So we need to make a change. So we did, and I think, you know, if you look not only at the public sector, but if you look at the private sector, the history of these massive new human resources, computer systems being introduced always have problems, many of them fairly serious. You don't hear about it as much in the private sector because they don't have to put their, you know, laundry out to be seen by everybody. In the public sector, we do. So what happened there was the process had kind of started underway under my predecessor, but I really accelerated it, and we engaged with a company to do it. And the farther we got into it, the more I started to hear it's not working. You know, the pilot stage stuff that we were doing with them was having all sorts of problems. And this is an interesting area in a university, more so than in, say, a corporation, where you would have more people who, you know, work at least on the timesheets 9 to 5, 5 days a week, 365 days a year minus 2 weeks vacation. In the university, we have all of these people who work 9 months a year, faculty. We have faculty whose salaries are paid off state money. We have faculty whose salaries are paid off federal money. We have faculty whose salaries are paid off private grant money. And we have many faculty whose salaries are paid all in the same year off all of those sources, sometimes together, sometimes 3 months on a federal grant, 3 months on a private, you know. And we have people who work to help us with the athletic events on spot jobs as ushers, security people, parking people. So the complexity of our human resources infrastructure is very high. So getting it right is difficult. And we were, again, doing this to save money across the system systematically. That is, part of what I said to folks was, look, this is going to require at each campus, modifying your business procedures to some extent, because each campus was doing things somewhat differently in the human resources area. And, of course, there's always great resistance to that. And people would rather say, no, you've got to customize the software rather than I have to change what I'm doing to make it a more standard procedure. So we ran into all of that kind of stuff. And finally, it got to the point where I got convinced that the company we were working with, the system that we were trying to install, really was not going to work. And, you know, as I said at the time, I could leave this and let it kind of limp along and, you know, probably have the next person come in my job and have a real disaster when it was discovered that this really wasn't working for all of the faculty and staff across the system. But I think that's not the right thing to do. I think, you know, we need to say we're going to move to a different vendor and we're going to get it right. We're going to start from scratch we're going to get it right the second time. So that was one of the hardest decisions I had to make, was to stand up and say, okay, here's why we're scrapping this. The money we've put into it, we've learned a lot. We're going to be a lot better when we get to the end line here with a new vendor, but the money we've spent with them is not going to be recouped. You know, they weren't going to give it back to us. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of something, you know, you wished wouldn't have gone the way it did, but again, it was a thing that has often major problems in any kind of organization. I'm happy to say that after, you know, not like boom, as soon as we got onto the new path, that was smooth. There were plenty of bumps along that way, but it's worked out well now. It's a good system, functioning well and accountable, and does a lot more things automatically than the old system did, and or maybe even forces employees to do a lot more of the work, in a sense, themselves, so you can hold down the cost of human resources staff, because a lot of employees are able to input things and take things out of the system directly from their own computers.
Mm-hmm. So, since we're on this track now, is there anything else that you can think of that didn't go as well as you had done?
Sure. Well, one of the controversies was over the issue of reserves. You know, how much do you hold in reserve in a big, big budget? And, of course, one of the interesting things generally about having a big system, and you have a big system, of course, so you can save money in part. Everybody isn't reduplicating the wheel on every campus. You have some services like human resources that are centralized, right? And you save bodies and you save dollars and equipment and time by virtue of having a centralized system for that. So when you talk about reserves across a system with 182,000 students, all the campuses we have, all the employees we have, if you're going to have what was recommended to be the right level of reserves, and this was recommended by the National Association of College and University Business Officers, and for a lot of other organizations, I think they'd say this is probably wise, between 20 and 25% of your operating budget, or 3 months' worth of operating budget, ought to be in reserve. And that's about what we had. But it got up, then, given the size of our overall budget, it got up to around $1 billion in reserves. And people said, oh, my God, they're, you know, they've been, look at all this money reserve they have, and they continue to raise tuition. And so that became a big controversy. And at that point, the legislature, when this came to their attention, they were at a place in the budget cycle where they were looking for some more money for K-12, especially in a couple legislative races where the party in control wanted their people to be able to say, oh, we're giving our local schools money. So this that became a pot that they could draw the money from. But to do that, they had to say, well, this is terrible. The university's done the wrong thing. And again, all outside business folks, I think, would say, boy, this was pretty good management, you know, in a really rough economic time. And, of course, what happened then was when big cuts were proposed, people said, well, you know, use your reserves. And the university said, well, you forced us to spend those down when Riley was leaving, and we, you know, now we're going to have to lay people off or close programs or cut services. So there's the yin and the yang of it that you're always struggling with. You know, one of the interesting questions, which hadn't been debated publicly, was what's the appropriate level of reserves, mm-hmm. in an organization like this, or any organization, and particular one like this. And again, we were following the received national wisdom that it was between 20 and 25%. And the regents knew this. We presented it to them in a public meeting in February. The kind of controversy started in April. And they said, fine. Now, some of them, when the controversy started, pretended that they, you know, hadn't known about it and didn't say fine. Some of them who knew about it and said fine. At the time, and the reserves were in our annual financial report, which was publicly available, talked about publicly at the February Regents meeting, and had a letter covering it from the Legislative Audit Bureau. The head auditor for the state signed it, saying this is in order. So that was an interesting controversy, and again, kind of politically and budget driven at the time.
So. Okay.
Yep.
So let's move on, unless there's other things that you want to say about, and maybe you can address it by just this general question, which is why retire?
Oh, well, so like I said, I was in the president's job in particular, but after 4 years as a chancellor and extension in the president's job, for almost 10 years, and that's a long time in that kind of job. I joke that, you know, they even let the President of the United States off for if you're after 8 years. And things, if you're doing the job in a way that isn't just sitting around and, you know, presiding and living in a nice house and collecting a nice paycheck, you use some chits and you get some people who are unhappy with your decisions, and that, you know, some of that accumulates over time. You also have people who like your decisions by and large, and they're supporters. But I think, you know, that's my feeling, was that that was probably a long enough run and that you wanted to move aside and let somebody else step in and see how they might do the job. Things do get a little repetitive, you know, after you go through the budget every 2 years, and after 10 years you've done it five times, and you kind of think, okay, this is not new in my world, and it's always interesting, but there may be other interesting things to do. And so I was 64 at the time, approaching, you know, standard retirement at 65, and I was 64 when I stepped out. And so that was on my mind, too, thinking, you know, there are other things I'd like to do. I don't want to retire in terms of stop working, but there really are some other things I'd like to do while I'm still young enough and healthy enough to do it. And I thought it had been a good run, by and large. And the changeover in the governor's office and, to a certain extent, in the legislature did play a role. And you know, this is not necessarily a good thing. I think in the old days, there was much less of a feeling of, well, if you were appointed as the university president by a board that was largely appointed by Governor X, when Governor X stepped out or lost, and Governor Y came in from a different party, that you needed to leave. I think the university was seen as less partisan. I think the regents kind of saw themselves as less partisan. But I think what's happened over time, as our politics generally have gotten much, much more partisan than they were in recent memory, not that they haven't been as partisan as this in history, which I think I've said before they have at points, but in recent memory they weren't that way. I think the university's become more captive to those kinds of partisan politics. So part of the reason I left was, well, I was appointed, you know, by a board that was appointed almost entirely by Governor Doyle. He was now gone. Governor Walker was in. And part of my thinking was, well, it might be better for the university if the current board, which was then being taken over really by Walker appointees, were able to appoint its own president and feel like this is the person we really want. We appointed him or her here. And I was ready. You know, I was really ready after 10 years of that job, 24/7, highly public, visible job. I was ready to, again, see what else was out there and smell the roses a little more. So I was fortunate in that I was invited down to work at the American Council on Education, which is the biggest professional membership association in higher education in the country. It's kind of an umbrella group for all of the other higher ed associations. And what I worked out there was, because I had some other things I wanted to do, was I'd work there half-time, 2 weeks a month, on leadership development, which was a lot of fun. They offer a lot of programs for people who are on the administrative track in one way or another in higher ed, department chairs, deans, vice presidents, provost, chancellors, and presidents. So I got to help them revise some of that and work with a lot of colleagues around the country on that. At the same time, the regents were gracious and gave me this appointment as a regent professor. So I had some time to prepare to teach, and I did then teach seminar on major challenges in American higher education at Madison, which was a lot of fun. After 15 months of working at ACE and preparing to teach and doing some other writing, I've been fooling around with a novel, which has been a lot of fun as well. But after 15 months of being in Washington 2 weeks every month and going back and forth, and then in spring of 2015, I was teaching at Madison, and so going back and forth, really going back and forth a lot because I was here teaching every week. And so I got tired of that commuting and decided I would not do that anymore, although I kept one interesting project with ACE that I'm still working on, and this is an effort to create a online teaching certificate for college faculty and college and university faculty. So the idea here is, can we get a really high quality product up that would be easily available for those wanting to be college faculty or those who are currently in the ranks, but feel they haven't had enough work on how to teach their discipline well. And that's, you know, kind of an underground rumbling that's been out there for a long, long time, and it's got a lot of validity to it. That is, so many of us were very well trained in our disciplines, but when it came to the question of, well, you can really understand and know a lot about James Joyce, but can you teach anybody else effectively about James Joyce? That latter question wasn't addressed very well. So this is an interesting project. It's still chugging along, and we'll see where it goes, but it's one that's near and dear to my heart, and that's been fun. And then recently I have an appointment as a senior fellow with the Association of Governing Boards, which is, again, Washington National Association of people who are on boards of trustees of all different kinds of colleges, public, private, two-year, four-year, big and small. So as a senior fellow there, I've been doing some writing for them. I have done some consulting with individual institutions. I facilitated a board of trustees retreat at Cleveland State University. I ran a number of sessions at a statewide meeting of public college trustees in Texas. I'm chairing a task force that the Association of Governing Boards has going on public university system boards as sort of unique trustee boards in the higher education landscape among the other kinds of boards. And they've also asked me to do things like presidential evaluations when a board of trustees wants to evaluate the president, when, you know, sometimes they want to bring in an outside person. So there's all sorts of very interesting work there, and I think, you know, increasingly boards, as higher education, again, gets more and more focus on it as a really important central function for the society, the role of trustees, board members for higher education institutions and systems has gotten more important, and kind of like in the corporate sector, it certainly is not anymore something that somebody going onto a board should suspect will be, well, we go to, you know, a couple nice cocktail parties four or five times a year, and then the next day get a bunch of reports from the president and his senior vice presidents and then pat him on the back and go home. You know, there's much more now expected of boards in the way of knowing what's going on at their institutions and ensuring that there's a strategic plan that's getting the institution to where it needs to be to meet its mission for its students and its other stakeholders. So it's been fun, and you know, these people, the trustees, are largely people from outside of higher education, many of them very, very successful in their other careers, but they come in very often not having much of a feel for what it's like to run an institution in higher education and what their role ought to be. And you know, one of the classic questions is, what's the difference between being a governor engaging in governance versus being a manager or a CEO, you know, and how do you work with the CEO effectively and closely, but you don't step into the CEO's work, but at the same time the CEO needs to keep you informed and take your advice when the will of the board is clear. So there's all sorts of interesting work to be done there. And then I just went on the board of the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. Just this month I've started there. I'm on the board of the HOPE Lab at UW-Madison, which is involved in looking at access to higher education for disadvantaged, lower-income students. Lots of interesting projects. The nice thing about the consulting work I'm doing now is I don't have to be in Washington half the time. I can do it from Madison, flying around the country. I still spend a lot of time in Washington, but don't have to be there and be renting an apartment and all that other kind of stuff. Although I must say I grew up in New York City, and so being in Washington even half time for 15 months was a little like back to the future. For me, I was back riding the metro like I rode the subway in New York going to high school. It's fun.
So I think we're close to 10 o'clock.
We are. Yeah, probably about, yeah.
So maybe just to try to talk about legacy.
Yeah.
In the remaining time we have.
Yep.
So my legacy question is, it's usually two parts. You know, what do you think you're going to be remembered for, and is it what you want to be remembered for?
Yeah. Well, and the answer to the first question, it's speculation, right? You don't know, and obviously a project like this is partly an effort to sort of say what you'd like to be remembered for, and that's good. But I'll mention a couple things in particular. I think I will be remembered for the growth agenda, and hope I would, because I think that was a central strategic framework and plan that we put together that really was very, very important for the future of Wisconsin and the country, and more states were doing that kind of thing, and we needed to be part of that. I think, again, guiding the university system through the toughest recession we've had since the Great Depression is an important thing that people will look when they look back at how did the university come through that, and I think it came through it pretty well given the enormous strain of the economy at the time. I think clearly keeping the system together, not having it break up, not having Madison leave it, not having each institution kind of walk out with its own board is something that will be looked at and argued about, and some people at some point will think, well, that was not an accomplishment, that was a failure, we should have done it the other way. And I think that'll be an ongoing argument because, as we've said, the structures of higher education are malleable, and there's kind of an ongoing argument all the time about what's the most efficient, effective way in this state at this time to have our institution structured. So that will be on the agenda, both positive and negative, probably. I hope the competency-based education, and that beyond that particular initiative, the sense that I really made some strong efforts to expand access for adult students, adult and working students during my time here, will be something that will be looked at and measures of success studied, and I hope nobody will say that was a bad thing, but we'll see. Another thing we haven't talked a lot about is there was an ongoing debate. It got louder toward the end of my tenure, I would say, and still going on pretty loudly now, about the purpose of higher education. And to put it in its starkest, simplest, sort of dumbest binary terms, a liberal arts and sciences education versus career education, as if the two were, totally separate things. So we were part of we were the first public university system to be part of a national initiative called Liberal Education and America's Promise, working with another Washington association, the Association of American Colleges and Universities. So this is AACNU, another acronym soup, Association of American Colleges and Universities. And so the notion there was to consciously talk about the value of liberal arts and sciences education, and this is really aimed very largely at baccalaureate degrees, and its connection to success in the workforce. So one of the things that this association did that we were part of was to interview a lot of CEOs and say to them, well, what are you looking for in people that you hire at Xerox or at General Motors or General Foods. And not surprisingly in some ways, although maybe counterintuitively to the way some people were thinking about it at the time, a lot of them said, well, we want people who can write clearly, who can speak persuasively, who are comfortable with numbers, are numerate, can use numbers to analyze data. We want people who can work effectively in groups with other employees. We want people who can work in diverse groups and have some appreciation for the global knowledge economy that our companies increasingly work in, and on and on. With those kinds of skills, habits of mind, knowledge bases that I think really are or should be the product of a good liberal arts education. So that was a fun thing to be involved in, and I think the right thing to keep reminding people, you know, when you have presidential candidates going around saying, well, there's no market for philosophers, or there's a market for welders. Well, as a matter of fact, somebody looked at the average annual income of philosophers versus welders, and guess what? The philosophers are making more money than the welders are. And again, it's that, you know, and we understand that silly season in presidential elections, and people say stuff because they feel they have to, but it's part of that binary thing that, you know, you've got to back career education or you back liberal arts education, and, you know, people get liberal arts educations, never get jobs, and et cetera, et cetera. Another thing this association has done is talk a little bit about the salaries of people who have liberal arts degrees and what they make in the course of their careers. So a lot of good work done there. And I think, again, as you can tell from some of the talks we've had earlier around issues like transfer, if we put our structures in place correctly, there's no reason that there can't be a lot of movement, let me call it, back and forth among more traditional career education and more traditional liberal arts education. So let me give you one example, and then I'll stop on this one. But I hope this is something that people will look at and that I'll be remembered for supporting and pushing. So one of the things we did was the two campuses up in northeast Wisconsin, UW-Oshkosh, UW-Green Bay, got together with their local tech college, and we worked with them to develop a Bachelor in Applied Studies programs. So these are what I like to call upside-down degrees because they were aimed at people who would graduate from the tech college with a technical major, 2-year degree, but then would go on into either Oshkosh or Green Bay wanting to get a baccalaureate degree. And some of those people might do that directly out of the tech college, but some of them may well be returning adult students, right, who go out and work for a while and realize, God, you know, if I want to get into any kind of managerial position, if I want to be eligible for different kinds of positions, if I want to have more of a hope of a salary increase, you know, even if I stay in this position for a while, having something more than a 2-year technical degree is really what I need to do. So these degrees, if you think of this, think of the image of this, you know, most of us start our baccalaureate degrees and they're broader at the base. That is, we take the broad general education courses in the first 2 years, and then we pick a major at the end of our sophomore year and then narrow down into a specialization for the major. Well, we flipped that. Visually, if you think of that triangle, but with the nose pointed down. So these students would start much more specifically in a career-oriented track and, in effect, earn a major in that track, and then would come in and do their general education as juniors and seniors, broaden themselves out so that if they wanted to go into a managerial position, for instance, and have a career ladder there that they mightn't, there are people who could say, no, I understand something about the world and the way it works, and I can articulate that beyond knowing something about this particular technical procedure. So that's a good example of how if we are committed to making possible pathways for students who start in a narrow career away but then want to have higher aspirations and want to broaden themselves out, you know, we can do it. And, you know, what we found, I think, not surprisingly, is that a lot of these students, when they came back and took the general education courses, were more committed to those courses, that kind of learning, because they were more mature. And it wasn't, you know, the 17-year-old saying, God, I want to major in political science. Why do I have to take Shakespeare? Or whatever the complaint is. So, I mean, I think you could argue in many ways that it makes more sense for students to do more of their general education at the higher levels when they are more mature and they have more of a base in a particular discipline. But that's not the way we've thought about it, for better or worse. So, but there are ways to accommodate new thinking as part of it. And I guess overall, try to say that you know, I hope I would be remembered as somebody who was open to new thinking and somebody who, through innovation and some vision and some moral persuasion, was able to advance the Wisconsin idea into the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And a century where, you know, the university has to redefine itself in order to be a real positive contributor to people in this global knowledge society that we now have. People can't live and survive in a kind of local cocoon in the way they used to. Even that person who's wants to be a welder is going to be doing that in a company that's likely competing with companies on an international level, or will be. And so it's a different and in some ways more interesting world, if more competitive one. And I hope that sense that the Wisconsin idea still holds. I mean, this notion that the university, it holds more than ever, you know, ought to be out around the state, and the boundaries of it ought to be the boundaries of the state. Well, more and more of our citizens are coming to the University of Wisconsin because they need to. They believe they need to. And I hope that I've made it more possible for them to do that in a quality way, and at the same time made the connection to the economic development role of the university in the 21st century in terms of creating new industries and new jobs. And again, I think that's grand language, but I think if you look back at the metrics, you can say, yeah, there was movement in those grand directions when Riley was president.
Kevin Riley, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. So this concludes the Oral History with Kevin Riley.